Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Say, why do we drink margaritas the size of our faces on Cinco de Mayo? Why do we eat turkey on Thanksgiving? Perhaps more interestingly, why are other countries Americanizing their food holidays? It's a big question. And here to help us make sense of it all is Willa Zenn of the Culinary Institute of America. Willa teaches Introduction to Gastronomy, Anthropology of Food, and Applied Food Studies. She's an expert on food and its relationship to tradition and culture. What food holidays stand out on your calendar? We want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also go to Facebook, WAMC Radio. You'll find a Vox Pop post there. You can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Tweet us, if you wish, at WAMC Radio. Just add the hashtag VoxPop. Or go to our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. There's a spot to comment there. Well, Willa Zenn, welcome.
Thanks for having me today.
You look a little tired.
Well, should I be? I'm happy to be here.
You just got back from Spain, I understand.
I did.
How was that?
Oh, well, let me tell you, if you've never had a chance to go to Spain, I definitely advise it. Although, you'll come back happy. I don't know about your liver.
There's some drinking done?
There's some drinking done. Some really interesting drinking traditions, food traditions, sun traditions, all of the above. But Spain's a great country to go to.
So you took students?
I had the pleasure of bringing our bachelor's students to Spain. At the Culinary Institute of America, we have these programs, two-week programs for students where they get an opportunity to study abroad in different countries. And Spain is one of the many destinations. That's the one I had the opportunity to travel to this time. But they go to places like France, Italy, China. We're also adding in Peru in the near future, and it gives them an opportunity to get a little sense of what it's like outside our own shores to the U.S. and to see how the other half lives, you know, how people eat, drink, and be merry.
So what messages are you trying to get through to the kids, and what message do they actually take away?
Well, I try to encourage them to be open-minded and good travelers and good, responsible citizens of the world. And I think they're...
How's that working out?
I think they listen, but I think their route to diplomacy is gastro-diplomacy and hands-on gastro-diplomacy, which means eating and drinking and being merry. And they do a great job at it. You know, one of the best memories we had, we went to Basque country, went out to the countryside. And we went out in Basque country. They have these big, beautiful traditional cider houses where the Basques go and they eat and drink. And it only runs a certain part of the year when the cider is pressed and stored in these big, giant casks that hold.
So this is like an Oktoberfest sort of thing, analogous to that?
It's like an Oktoberfest with your own clothes. You don't have to wear uncomfortable leather pants because those don't have a lot of stretch when you're eating, let me tell you. So you can wear your own clothes, you can wear your stretchy sweatpants, and what you do is that the big barrels of cider are there, and there's sort of the cider house master, and he'll start off and shout something in Basque, which contains too many T's and X's to spell. It's called choch. It's actually spelled a T-X-O-T-X. And it takes me a while to remember how to spell
right.
that. And he says, choch, and that says, you know, start the merriment, start the cider, and he releases the tap, and the cider streams out from this tap, and this is where we get into a very sophisticated talents. This could be an Olympic sport for the Basques, where everybody lines up in a row, all ducks in a row. Everybody's got their glass. It's like a pint glass, and everybody goes and catches the stream of cider, and one after the other. You can't spill a drop, otherwise you're the party foul. You have to catch exactly two fingers worth. Anything more, you're considered a little gauche, and anything else, you're considered a wimp.
And I guess you're good at this, right?
I've become an expert, apparently. I've become very good at it, measuring. Years of user working in the hospitality industry and pouring beverages and make me expert at it. And so you catch those two fingers worth, you drink it in one drop, and then you go and eat all sorts of traditional dishes, you know, egg omelet, tortilla and bacalao, tortilla with bacalao, salted cod, and it's cooked there. You have bread, you have roasted meats, and it's just a feast, and you're sharing, you're participating in commensality, and it's good exposure in that gastro-diplomacy side, you know, is that when you start eating foods of other people, you kind of say, okay, I don't understand a lot about them, but I start feeling closer to them because I eat their food, I'm doing this fun cider-catching ritual, and after a while, you feel like you're Basque yourself, and we had a lot of moments like that on that trip.
How did you, Willa Zenn, get involved and interested in sort of a very narrow subject? The anthropology of food is just, it's a niche.
It is a niche in some ways, but, you know, let me tell you, I dare, double dog dare you to find a human being on the planet who doesn't have some sort of relationship to food. Even if you don't like food, you got something to say about it. We all have to eat. It's one of the very few things that makes us all human. And there's a few other, you know, activities also equally pleasurable that make us human too.
Right.
But eating.
That's another show.
That's another show. Yeah. Maybe a little R-rated for this.
Right.
But it's one of those things where everybody has to eat. And so everybody has comments about it, whether it's you like something, you don't, you have food issues, you have fears, you have excitements. All of it is that. And when I was studying anthropology, I started in college, I was very much interested in other cultures and other places. I think it was really an excuse to leave home and get as far as I could away from my parents.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this was a good cover story to say I want to study other cultures and become an anthropologist. And so food was really interesting to me because I like to eat. I like to cook. And, you know, I get to call it research originally. You know,
you can
like
write it off, too.
I can write it
it's
off
very,
very
nice.
Nicely.
Sure.
And say, you know, I'm doing research, so I have to, I must eat out at this place tonight, or I must buy these ingredients.
Sure.
And
A number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. We're joined today by Willa Zenn of the Culinary Institute of America. Willa teaches Introduction to Gastronomy, Anthropology of Food, and Applied Food Studies at CIA. Once again, the number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. In the introduction that Jessica, our producer, writes for me, we talked about briefly the Americanization of food holidays. And you and I spoke in the green room about this, and you think there's a very simple sort of reason that that's happening.
Well, the simple, if you want a two-second answer, I have a theory, and there's definitely marketing evidence and some sociological and anthropological evidence for it. Basically, you know, holidays, a lot of them that have become really mass marketed and commercial Americanized holidays, things like Cinco de Mayo, which we recently celebrated, St. Patrick's Day, Mardi Gras, and increasingly Chinese New Year. A lot of it is because it becomes a good drinking holiday, that there's beverages, alcoholic beverages, that go with them, and it becomes a good way to kind of let your guard down and celebrate and become one with that group that you probably didn't know very much before, but now because you drink their beverages and you're feeling very merry after, you start feeling a little bit closer to that. And so, it becomes a little bit more American.
So is alcohol the secret of history?
Alcohol is a secret to a lot of things, but definitely when we're talking about, you know, if we want to talk about in history, rites, rituals, magic, you know, there's alcohol involved oftentimes. But with, you know, celebrations, if we think about, you know, celebrating an event, we think of opening a nice bottle of bubbly, a birthday, you might have a toast, you know, graduations, things like that. Alcohol shows up in a lot of places, in a lot of cultures, as celebration, as ritual, as fun, as just enjoyment.
I would assume that money is involved and marketing is involved in the Americanization of holidays as well. Cinco de Mayo, not really a thing in Mexico, per se, right?
Not at all. What it is Cinco de Mayo originally was, it's actually commemorating a battle where the Mexican army actually beat the French completely unexpectedly. It's the Battle of Puebla, 1862. And the Mexicans were completely outnumbered. We're talking something like some historians say something about like 4,000 Mexicans to 8,000 French. And the French were really a serious army at this point with Napoleon III. And they beat them. And it was in Puebla. It's about 80 miles away from Mexico City. And they beat them. And so it became a local holiday in Puebla to celebrate our victory. And it became sort of a national symbol and the big idea that historians will write about it. But locally, it was not really a holiday. People didn't go out drinking. They didn't have parades. They didn't buy silly hats and drink margaritas. None of that existed. And in Mexico nowadays, it's recognized as an important day in their history, but it's not Mexican Independence Day. It's not a drinking holiday. And some people in Puebla might, you know, have a little ceremony to commemorate that victory, but it's not the party that we make it up to be north of the border.
So it hasn't spread. In other words, we haven't exported our version, our Disneyfied version of their real holiday.
Well, let me tell you, whenever you're an American wandering abroad and you'll at some point find this, there's always a lonely Mexican or Tex-Mex restaurant somewhere. And it's almost always opened by some American expat who got stuck there. And they will almost invariably celebrate Cinco de Mayo and have some frozen margaritas and some limp nachos for you. But aside from those couple of outposts, it's not really anything that they've picked up elsewhere, unless an American's brought it over as a holiday and found a way to sell some dishes or sell some booze for that day.
And St. Patrick's Day, to some extent, is the same thing.
St. Patrick's Day has its roots in Irish-American nationalism. And same with Cinco de Mayo, that, you know, they got taken up here north of the border, or in case of Cinco de Mayo, but in case of St. Paddy's Day, it got taken up here in America a lot more than it did in Ireland, because it, you know, first sort of it became reclaimed as, you know, finding traditions to hold on to. You know, for Cinco de Mayo is really in, we're thinking about the rise of the Chicano and Chicana movement, and especially in the 60s and 70s, you know, finding holidays to say, yeah, we who are Chicano and Chicana have holidays, we have traditions, we have a deep history, we matter, and we should rise up and say, well, our day should be celebrated too. St. Paddy's Day, very similar story, but predates that a lot more. It definitely goes back to the arrival of the Irish in the Americas. And in Ireland, St. Patrick's Day is really a religious holiday.
Yeah.
You know, a couple people celebrate it. Those who are particularly devout Catholics will celebrate St. Patrick. You know, he's considered the patron saint of the Isles. And that's because of his work converting the pagan Irish to Christianity. And, you know, and the green and the shamrock all kind of became tied into that. You know, the shamrock kind of looks like a cross, and the shamrock was used, the folklore goes, to explain the Holy Trinity and all that. So, when the Irish Americans came over, a very similar story. You know, the Irish Americans were really not respected in much of American history until fairly recently. And they were considered sort of outcasts because they're Catholic, because many of them were poor, and newspapers of the time wrote about them very bad ways. So having a St. Patrick's Day celebration was sort of an invented holiday to kind of say, we're Irish, we're here, we have traditions, we're valuable people. And, it, you know, some of the earliest sort of St. Patrick's Day parade, the first one on record goes back to 1762.
Really?
Fairly small, sober event. But over the years, it became more and more of a public display as the numbers of Irish grew in America, especially in places like New York and Boston. Bigger parades, more festivals, and it grew out of being just a sort of church religious holiday to a show of national identity amongst the Irish, to the point where today, you know, everybody's a little bit Irish on St. Patrick's Day, as Guinness Guinness likes to promote.
Yeah, and then it comes down to money once again. Zach, we'll take a quick break here. We are joined today by Willa Zen of Culinary Institute of America. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Terrapin Red Bistro. Serving Mother's Day dinner this Sunday from 1 p.m. to 8 p.m., organic kids menu will be available for kids under 12. TerrapinRestaurant.com. Manny's TV and Appliances, family owned since 1977, now offering olive oil from his vineyards in Crete. Available at Atkins, River Valley Market, Randall's, Foster's, and Big Y grocery stores. Manny'sOliveOil.com. The Beechwood Group of Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC. Serving not-for-profits and individual investors, Mary McDonald, Financial Advisor, and Joseph Steininger, CFP, Financial Advisor, TheBeechwoodGroup.com. And Radio Woodstock's Craft Brew Boogaloo, Saturday, May 23rd, Canteen Field, Saugerties, over 150 craft beers from 75 breweries, farm-to-table food, live music, and artisans, CraftBrewBoogaloo.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. We talk anthropology and food today. Willa Zen of Culinary Institute of America. So you started out as an anthropology student.
I did. Well, actually, before that, as an undergraduate, I did international relations, and that got the bug, and I started taking anthropology classes and moved into that and became an anthropologist.
So I imagine one of the certainly not 401 level courses you had to take or teach about the anthropology of food. We talk about American Thanksgiving and how far it is removed from what it was in the beginning.
Well, Thanksgiving is such a great holiday to talk about, and not just with American students, but we at the Culinary Institute get a lot of students from abroad.
Yeah.
And it's having to explain to them, or listening to how their friends and classmates explain to them, okay, so this is why we eat this or this or this, and this is a story. And I think that's the key word to focus on, is that it's a story, that we've invented this idea that you have to have the bird, you have to have these side dishes. And that whole image of that classic, you know, turkey on the table, beautiful, beautifully laid table with perfect china and everybody's gathered around and smiling. That idea really comes from the 40s. In particular, if you can think and imagine, you know, those Norman Rockwell paintings, and especially that Freedom from Want painting, the one with the happy family and the starch white tablecloth and the patriarch and matriarch at the front serving that beautiful bird and the patriarch's ready to carve in, comes from the 40s. You know, that painting was done in 42, and it was published in 1943 in the Saturday Evening Post, one of the many Norman Rockwell paintings. And he painted that inspired by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a local guy to this area of the world.
Yeah.
We might know him. Yeah. You may have heard of him. And it's inspired by a speech that he gave in 41 about a State of the Union address, actually, on the four freedoms that, you know, we as Americans, as, you know, as we're headed towards the brink of war, World War II, and entering as Americans into the war, you know, talking about the fact that we should all have freedom of speech, that we should have freedom of worship, but also we should have freedom from bad things. The freedom from want, that we should not be poor and hungry and not need. And the freedom from fear, that we should feel secure and safe. And so that whole idyllic message, you know, of the Thanksgiving and the family and the gathering, you know, there's been different variations throughout American history of what Thanksgiving is, but the one that we stick with today that we love to tell ourselves, and the ones that my students tell to their international friends at school, and the one that I'm often having to explain to them too and get them to talk about in class, really starts in the mid-20th century, around the 40s.
So what can we learn about America based on that ideal, or the ideal of Thanksgiving, and sort of the image of what we want it to be? What then can you say, and perhaps the way it is now, which is certainly not the way it was in the 40s exactly. So where are we going, and what can you learn about this country?
Well, when we think about Thanksgiving, right, and any other holiday, whatever holidays matter to you, whether it's Christmas, Easter, Mardi Gras, if that's your holiday, St. Patrick's Day, it's a lot of what we want it to be, right? We as Americans are great at fashioning and refashioning ourselves. And so the holidays evolve as our cultural values evolve and what we want evolves. And so that early picture, you know, we stick with that idea because it's a fantasy of what we imagine Thanksgiving to be, that everything's perfect, everybody's smiling, China, the fancy china's out, perfect tablecloth. And when we actually do it, I don't know about you, but if you've ever had to cook Thanksgiving for a whole crowd, it's pretty darn stressful.
Yeah, just to look at me, you'd probably answer that I don't have to cook for anybody, and that's the case.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Is there more navel-gazing in America, or are all the holidays overly idealized in other countries?
Well, everybody idealizes an event, you know, I mean, in different ways, but we all kind of have our ideals of what we want life to be. And then when it happens in reality, you know, the ideal is that I will have my perfectly starched tablecloth and everybody will be smiling and the turkey's perfect. Reality is, and this is where Hollywood makes a lot of money making silly movies for the holiday season, you know, the turkey's burnt, the dog ate half of it, the kids are crying, the in-laws are fighting, something's happening, nobody's smiling, or, you know, that's half of, you know, sitcoms around that time of year focus on the disaster stories of Thanksgiving and how things don't work out and you laugh about it because it becomes okay anyway. Well, Christmas movies, the same thing, you know, the disasters of the stress of trying to achieve that perfection, it actually becomes more stressful to reach that ideal and actually kind of accepting what it is.
Willa Zinn is our guest of the Culinary Institute of America. It's Food Friday. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Where are you taking your students next?
Well, I'm taking them to all of the glamorous fourth floor classrooms that we have.
Oh,
this
that's
Friday.
All you have left.
That's
huh?
all I have left.
The big trip is done.
The big trip is done for now. That's all I've got for them now, and there will be adventures in the future. I mean, that's one of the things that's really nice about the Culinary Institute is that the students have these opportunities to travel, not just with our bachelor's program study abroad opportunities for these two-week trips, but we also have branch campuses now where we have different concentrations in places like Napa Valley.
Oh, that's nice.
It's not too shabby, especially in the fall. I hear they do some pretty good grape juice. And San Antonio is another one. We've also got a campus in Singapore. It's a little bit more far off, but that's also another one of those destinations that we have. So we've got a variety of programs for our students, and there's many opportunities for them nowadays beyond sort of the traditional idea of a chef being in a kitchen.
That's interesting. Are the foodies book smart?
They absolutely are. You know, the thing about being somebody who's a very talented chef and a talented hospitality professional or a food professional, which includes doing things like food anthropology, you do have to read a lot. Sometimes it doesn't come off that way in some of these TV shows and programs, but you actually have to be incredibly read, incredibly savvy with the news and technology and social media, and to have a lot of different skills to pull up upon to be able to say, I know these things. And part of that with food is that there's an endless amount of things to read and learn about and experience and taste, and so you have to have that drive there and to keep that sort of well-read attitude about yourself.
Can you cook? Are you good?
Oh, I can waltz around the stove.
Okay. Do you have when you got the job at CIA? Did they say, well, look, you're fine with the book smarts, but you have to show us what you can do?
They actually put me in a secret room, and I had to do a secret MasterChef cook-off. And Gordon Ramsay, who's the host of? Well, Gordon Ramsay or whoever the chef host of MasterChef came out and put me under quickfire. No, actually, I actually have a very interesting background. My work is formally in anthropology and the anthropology of food. But actually, what I studied as part of that was I looked at how chefs in China train to become chefs, and I trained as a chef myself in China.
Really?
Studying cooking schools there and learning how to use a wok, how to work a cleaver. So I know my way or two around the stove.
Well, that's a great question that many people have around here. The Chinese restaurants in America, not so like the Chinese food in China, right?
Well, it's actually fabulous that you bring up that question. It's something that I've been talking about with colleagues a lot lately. In fact, a group of colleagues and I were talking about this very question the other night. There's a lot of shift and change. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about that Americanization, is that to be smart and savvy and part of what you do also when you go to a new place and have a new identity, you kind of reform yourself and refashion yourself to whatever's necessary. So Chinese food in America, some of it's adapted to the local palate here, and others, you know, still kind of looks a lot like what you see in China.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, here's one that came in via email. This is from Jamie. And again, if you want to give this a call, it's 1-800-348-2551. This is from Jamie. It says, the parade was used for political functions, whereby all of the important political leaders and candidates could be seen by the public. It is, I assume they're talking, oh, St. Patrick's Day. It is a drinking holiday because those political persons would go from pub to pub or home to home to secure the vote. No one could write, so visual cues were all important. I would not be surprised if the food tradition was based on, you never know when the entourage would come by, so the food was the type that was always ready, and while you waited, you drank. Comment?
Well,
wrong, right?
No, absolutely.
You're the
I mean, the well, I don't know if I'd use that word.
No.
But I dabble a thing or two. No, parades were actually definitely a big part of the political process. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about parades, having these holidays as a marker of your identity and your status. I mean, when you're out there having a parade, it says you're here. You can't, you know, even if people choose to ignore, they can't because they'll hear you. Even if you turn your eyes away or your head away, they will hear you or feel your presence and know that you're marching down the street. And so it's absolutely a political function. And another example to think about parades, you know, Chinese New Year is a good one. When we go down to Chinatown, the city, for Chinese New Year, you know, the Chinese don't parade in China. They don't do any of the dragon dancing publicly like that. Dragon dances exist, but they don't parade up and down Chinatown and do all that show that they do here. And a lot of that was because it was an Americanization, adopting other ethnic groups' habits of parading and saying, we're here, we're on the streets, you can't avoid us. This is us claiming our space, literally claiming the street and saying we're here. The Irish eating kind of gets wrapped up too. I mean, with St. Patrick's Day, the food of St. Patrick's Day, corned beef, cabbage, you know, potatoes. I mean, there's a lot of discussion as to, you know, how Irish is that meal. Cabbage, certainly. Many parts of the world eat cabbage, potatoes.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But with the corned beef, there's speculation. There's not really a good idea who invented that, but there's a lot of speculation saying that maybe they borrowed that from the Jewish, who are also living in the same parts of New York, you know, on the Lower East Side, that they're borrowing pastrami making and kind of adapting it to their own ends. Because Irish really eat more pork than beef. And so that wasn't really part of their diet. And the way it's corned and all that kind of looks like pastrami a little. So there's Americanizations and borrowing from other Americans, too, in that story, too. But they got fed, right? And if you think about the typical foods, Irish cooking is a lot of boiling.
Yep.
It's a good way, cheap way to feed a lot of people with low tech.
Right. But you lose some of the flavor.
You do. But, you know, when it's St. Patrick's Day, you do it because it's part of the celebration, right? It's part of that feel of it's what you're supposed to do.
All right.
Expectation.
Let's go to the phones and Richard in Clinton Corners. Richard, you're on with Willa Zen.
Yeah, hi, Willa. I have a quick question. What's your opinion on the infusion of French cuisine in Vietnam as reference to Ho Chi Minh and his culinary background training?
Thanks for your question, Richard. And I think that's a fabulous question. So for those of you who haven't heard this little story before, Ho Chi Minh, before he became the great political leader that he was known for, he was known for being a bit of a cook. He was actually pretty good in the kitchen, knew his way around or two. And the legend was that he actually lived around the world, traveled around. He actually even worked for the great Auguste Escoffier, the great French chef at certain points, and learned a thing or two for them. There's not really great accounts of how much he actually learned and how close he was to the great culinary god. But what it is that with French cuisine, it wasn't just Ho Chi Minh. It was actually long before that. You know, remember, the French colonized Vietnam and various parts
right.
of Southeast Asia, Indochine. You know, if you think about that great Catherine Deneuve movie, it's all about the French colonization and the leaving of Southeast Asia. And so a lot of things crossed over. You know, the French introduced certain things to Vietnamese cuisine, things like baguettes into dishes like banh mi. Certain seasonings and ingredients, like the Vietnamese love of use of things like mayonnaise and aioli, totally adapted from, mayonnaise rather than aioli, excuse me, adapted from French cuisine and French repertoire. So the Vietnamese cuisine has legacies of that from the French colonization, but also from other civilizations encountered there, like the Chinese and others in that region.
Richard, thank you very much for the call. Let's go over to Bill in Rhinebeck, 1-800-348-2551. Bill, you're on.
Yes, I was wondering if Asian cuisine or Chinese cuisine in particular are different on the East and West Coast, and if so, why?
Difference between Chinese food on the East and West Coast. Okay. You're talking to your handler. Jeff Levine is here. You're always here. Every time there's a guest from the CIA, you're always here, Jeff, and you're always causing trouble. All right, did you catch the question, Willa?
Yeah, so thanks for your call, Bill. So, East Coast, West Coast. Well, you know, that's an ongoing debate on so many levels. I mean, who's got better beaches on the East or West Coast? Who's got a better sunset? And that debate definitely goes on to extend to food. Who's got better Chinese cuisine? It's not a question of better, but actually a question of who's making it. And you have very different populations that ended up on the East Coast versus West Coast, different generations of migrants. And so, for instance, here in the East Coast, especially in New York City, Manhattan, and Flushing, and Queens especially, you have people who came in from places like Fujian Province in the southeast of China, Taiwan. And so you see those cuisines represented here a lot more. On the West Coast, depending on where you're at in the West Coast, in pockets like San Francisco, the Central Valley, or Los Angeles, particularly in the San Gabriel Valley, you have Taiwanese immigrants. You also see a lot of Cantonese food represented. So it's not really a difference of what's better or worse, but who went where and what types of cuisines you see represented as a result. I'm a West Coast kid, so I'm a little bit more partial to the West Coast. But after being here for a couple years on the East Coast, I have to say I've come to accept it.
Oh, that's good. All right, Bill.
Thank you so much. I'm a first-time caller also.
Hey, well done. You want to follow up while you're here?
No, I'm good. Thank you very much.
All right, man. Thanks for the call. 1-800-348-2551. Why the smirking among the CIA folks? That's what I want to know. No answer, Jeff? Oh, let's turn Jeff's mic on there, Zach. Go ahead, Jeff.
We think we know who Bill is.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he's a troublemaker?
Oh, no. It was a very good question.
All right, fair enough. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a short break. Willa Zen is here, and we'll be back with more of your calls in a moment.
Support for WAMC comes from Cafe Capriccio, offering dining and catering with Tuscan cuisine in Albany, New York, and Neapolitan cuisine in Saratoga Springs. CafeCapriccio.com for reservations. And Fidelis Care, offering health insurance coverage for children and adults of all ages in New York State. FideliscCare.org.
Well, the things you learned. 1-800-348-2551. We're talking to Willa Zen today. Yeah, General So, he existed. He was real. And it's not exactly the dish is not exactly representative of the person, though.
No, General So is actually a real person. He's actually a real general and quite well known. In China, they have this tradition of naming dishes after famous folks.
Still alive?
Maybe in sort of some haunted crypt somewhere.
Okay.
But
so
by and large, we haven't found any. I think he's pretty dead.
Okay, fair enough.
And, but they have this tradition of naming dishes after people, beautiful courtesans, emperors, and generals. Military generals show up in a lot of dishes. And so General So was actually a real general, but he wasn't known for cooking. He wasn't even really known for having a good chef or anything like that. He was just known for his military might. And for those of you who are interested, there's actually a great documentary about it called The Search for General So. It's in some independent cinemas and it's been making the rounds. But it talks about the evolution, how this general got associated with this deep-fried battered dish, chicken dish. And it's tasty. But let me tell you, even General So, that dish looks different wherever you go. I mean, there's adaptations. People would add in things like peanuts or broccoli or whatever, depending on the audience, who's cooking and where they're cooking.
Okay. Here's one that came in via email from Bill. I'm going to New Orleans for the first time in a couple of weeks. Can you recommend any anthropologically correct restaurants or other food activities? That's from Bill. Okay.
Well, with anywhere you go, right? I don't like to be a guidebook for anybody. I've traveled a little bit in my life, I like to say, but I don't like to be a guidebook in the sense because whenever you print something, it becomes doctrine. You know, you have to go there and it becomes really unfair. Go out, go where the locals are. If your nose says something smells good, go and eat there.
Yeah.
If you see there's a line out the door or people are headed that way, go there. Talk to cabbies. They're excellent sources of advice of where people on the ground go. And that's where I go when I travel, with my anthropologist brain, is I try to see what the people do and where they're eating. Not necessarily the fanciest place in town, although there's definitely occasions for that, but just seeing what people like to do and where they go for a good night out.
Let's go to Star in Valencia. Star, you're on.
Hi, I'm wondering if you guys know of any kind of food that the capital region is well known for, either historically or currently.
Thanks, Star, for your question. Well, I would say, and I'm not native to this area, so this is from my sort of anthropological hat rather than being a native of this area, but I would have to say this area is not known for a dish as much as rather ingredients, and that's the sense I've always gotten from the Hudson Valley, is that everybody talks about it being known for ingredients that are great, or nowadays beverages, the rich distilling tradition and winemaking tradition that's come up here. So we're just talking... You're hearing a lot more about, great cheeses, great dairy products, great apples, produce, whiskey, bourbons, and wines. You hear that coming up a lot more about the Hudson Valley and the Capital Region rather than, this is one dish that represents the place. You don't have something like a po' boy representing, there's nothing the equivalent of that, like a po' boy for, Louisiana,
right,
for this area, or like Chesapeake Bay crabs or anything like that.
Fried Hudson River cod or anything like that.
Yeah, those,
some
I think.
PCBs and whatnot.
Yeah, no? I wouldn't advise eating those.
No, I'm kidding, of course. Beer is actually huge around here. The brewing tradition, 1700s. The Dutch, a lot of Dutch around this area. Star, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah, plenty of beer in this area, plenty of great brewers. What food were the Dutch famous for back in the 1600s?
Well, the Dutch, even if you eat Dutch food today, their diet's a little bit more what we call sort of bland and beige.
Yeah.
So lots of wheat-based foods, things that are made out of flour, sort of simple seasoning, simple sauces, and you still see that carrying through. If you're talking about that time period, you didn't have the most varied of cuisines. Because at that point, they're still just starting their farms, starting crops. So you had sort of meats, sort of breads, and that was really it at that point. Cultivation of products rather than anything exciting at that point.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. You've been all around the world in the course of your studies and fun times. What's the most exciting place to go for a holiday, food-wise?
The most exciting thing to go for a holiday, food-wise, is a tricky question. You can go anywhere on the planet, but you can also go take the train down to New York City and experience the world there, too.
Well, that's noncommittal.
I know. But it's It's sort of a cheater's answer, right? If you can't travel very far, go to New York because you can experience a lot of different cultures in one city, in one place, for the ride of a train ticket. But if you have to go other places, you know, there's all sorts of different interesting cultural traditions all over.
What's your favorite?
Some of the coolest things I've had the chance to go experience, Chinese New Year actually in China. Anything unlike it because you have a billion plus people celebrating the same holiday with you at the same time. And if you think the malls are pretty packed here at Christmas, try that in China with a billion other people trying to get their shopping done at the same time.
Cool.
Fireworks, food everywhere. But other really kind of neat culinary traditions around the planet. I mean, if you think about the Christmas markets and the holiday markets in Germany and in Switzerland and in Europe during the holidays, absolutely beautiful. Everybody's out in the street and, you know, drinking hot beverages, buying little trinkets, listening to carolers, lights are up. And it's very magical. And there's many others I can go on, but those are the couple off the top of my list.
Okay, here's one, Will Azen, that came in via email from Mark. My question is about pizza. Pizza in our country seemed to start off as something found only in Italian neighborhoods. But now it seems like it's in every neighborhood, enjoyed by all people across America. Everybody likes it, no matter how rich or poor they are or where they came from. Is there a relationship between pizza's universal appeal and people in our culture coming together?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, pizza is one of those great dishes. It's probably one, I mean, pizza and hamburgers are two of the great American exports, even though they're not, their origins don't date back to America. I mean, pizza goes back to the Italians, particularly the people around Neapolitan area. It's actually become a very American dish, and what's interesting is that it's one of those dishes that it's interactive, it's fun, it's also communal because it's cut in slices, everybody takes a piece, everybody's sharing the same thing, you're all eating the same food. And the thing that's interesting is that if you go around the planet and eat pizza, the version of pizza that gets exported out is not often the Italian-style pizzas with thin crusts and blistered wood stove cooking. It's often actually an American-style pizza, Sicilian-style, with a thick crust, fluffy dough, really thick red sauce, lots of cheese. And that's the version you see popping up everywhere, from Nairobi to Tokyo.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so it's that sweeter sauce version. It's thicker, and it's an American pizza that people are sharing around the world, eating together.
We're joined today by Will Azen of Culinary Institute of America. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Johanna in Albany. You're on.
I just wanted to state that what this area was known for was shad.
Shad?
Albany, yes, it was called Albany beef, actually.
Yes, that escaped my brain earlier. And it was, Jeff, my colleague here, is just pointing that out. Yes, this Hudson Valley and the fisheries, when it did exist, shad was a big part of this industry and part of the local eating.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Fair enough. Thanks
That's
a lot.
Thanks for the
say.
Comment.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for the comment.
Let's go over to Mark in Liberty. Mark, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just recently in New Mexico and had some really wonderful food and would like to know the major difference between Mexican food and New Mexican food.
All right, Mark. Well, I'm glad you had a great time in New Mexico. It's a beautiful state. And I hope you got to have some of those great hatch chilies down there and some green chili.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's part of the difference is that, you know, in New Mexico, they kind of have their own cuisine, borrowing from the Mexican traditions, but making it their own. Things like the New Mexico hatch chili is a classic symbol that a lot of New Mexicans like to talk about as their thing. That's this green chili. It's fire roasted in this The best way to describe it, it's this basket, and if you've ever been to a bingo hall, it looks like the drum that people draw bingo numbers out of. They roast in that drum, and it gets this nice smoky char in it. It's used to, and they use it and put it in chilies. And that's part of it, is that they like that smoke, they like the flavor. They borrow a lot from northern Mexican cuisine, so you'll see things like flour in their menus a lot more. But also, they have their own distinct traditions, like make that chili in particular and celebrating that flavor there. And when we talk about Mexican cuisine, you know, it's huge diversity depending on what state you're looking at. So, you know, for New Mexico, they draw a lot more on a little bit of on one side of the border across in Mexico, but also the American influences, too, with flour and all that.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thanks
Thank
for your
you,
call.
Mark. Brilliant indeed. Let's go to Gloria in Longmeadow, Mass. Gloria, you're on.
Hi, yes. In terms of the East Coast, West Coast food differences or issues, I moved out to Oregon 13 years ago and discovered Manila clams and razor clams. Neither of which you see on menus here. Manila clams are delightful because there's no sand. They're little teeny clams, but no sand in them. Very sweet. And razor clams, you order them and you get like one steak that's made out of one clam, which is like really weird, but it's delicious. And I didn't want to become a salmon snob, but I did. I just can't face Atlantic salmon anymore.
Wow.
The other thing I noticed, so many restaurants in Oregon and California and Washington also, if you're ordering steamed clams and butter and garlic and wine sauce, if you're allergic to tomatoes, ask them about the tomatoes, because there are so many meals that they put out where sun-dried tomatoes are automatically thrown in, and they never list them on the menu. And that really threw me until I got used to asking about it, because I'm allergic to tomatoes.
So you're strictly a West Coast fan at this point.
No. I never had a popover on the West Coast.
All right.
No, and I'm a New England clam chowder person. I'm really schizophrenic about it. It's just there are some things I really prefer on the West Coast now.
That's very interesting about the New England clam chowder. There are six or seven different kinds, right? Just around
right.
The East. I got to say Manhattan's better.
Pardon?
I got to say Manhattan style is better.
Oh, no, I disagree. I like, well, there's tomatoes.
Yeah, that's
Manhattan
right.
Style.
Yeah.
But I love both, you know, classic New England with cream, and I also love the Rhode Island clam chowder.
Oh, you do the Rhode Island as well. And there's what, a South Carolina, North Carolina?
There's a lot of other regional variations on clam chowder, you know, but for a West Coast kid, the only idea of clam chowder you had was the stuff that came out of the can, and that was always white New England clam
right.
chowder. That's the world.
Right.
That's the version that gets sold to the world.
Well, thank you, Gloria, very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Oh, I'm enjoying the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number, 1-800-348-2551. Well, we've been all over the world here today. We could talk about, what do you want to talk about for the last 8 or 9 minutes of the program?
Well, is there anything about food that you particularly love that you're gravitating to?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm still upset that there hasn't been a German-American parade around here and celebrating my ancestors.
Well, we definitely have Oktoberfest. I mean,
but not around here, right?
Not so much in the capital region. I mean, there's a pretty good representation of German American restaurants and German restaurants in this part of the world. You definitely see German food showing up on menus, and it's become a lot more popular in the recent years to see German and Austrian food show up. So Germans aren't—they're loved. They're not too neglected.
Have you taken your class? Now I know you've taken them to the Basque region for Cider Day or whatever they want to call it. Have you taken them to Oktoberfest?
Well, I don't know if they can handle Oktoberfest. I can, but I don't know if they can.
I bet they can. No, they haven't. You haven't taken them.
I haven't taken them. No, we haven't. We don't have a German trip yet planned for our core of study abroad programs, but it could be in the future.
Which European country has the lamest food?
Has the lamest food?
Yeah. England, right?
No, I spent many years living in the UK, and well, to be fair, certain parts of England have fabulous food, and other parts are still kind of what we expect, the sort of
boiled beef,
the Monty Python sketch, the bad food. But in the major cities, in London, Manchester, you get some absolutely great food and some of the best on the planet.
Are you a fan of haggis? Do you like to go to Scotland and have some haggis?
I can take the offal, but not everybody can.
No? So you can do it, huh?
I can do it. Well, you know, part of it is you have it for Robbie Burns night, so you're having enough whiskey anyway where sort of the haggis disappears.
It just doesn't matter. Right. Let's go to Francis in Warwick. Francis, you're on.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if you could recommend a good website for Chinese recipes.
Absolutely. Thanks for your call, Francis. It depends on what you want to do. And I'm going to be a little bit academic and snobby here for a second and say Chinese food, there's huge regional variations. And so it depends on what region you're interested in. So start with one and then, you know, kind of work your way and go down the rabbit hole. A couple of ones that I really like, there are a couple bloggers and I'll recommend a couple books too. One of them is actually a friend of mine, Kokian Lam. He has this great website called Red Cook. And the thing that's interesting about it, it's not just recipes, but he actually explains and demystifies technique, which is often the hardest part of Chinese food for most people, is that if it's a stir fry, well, if you've never done it before, there's actually a lot of nuance to it. And depending on the chef you're talking to in China, they'll say there's 9 different ways to stir fry. So he actually breaks that down to make it more accessible. And that's one I would start off with just off the top of my head.
Okay, Red Cook.
redcook.net, and you can start searching from there. There's also a lot of books, and one of the ones I'd recommend really quickly off the top of my head is called Mastering the Art of Chinese Cooking. It's an older one, out of print, but you can get it online for cheap. And same thing, it actually talks technique and explains why certain things are cooked the way they are in Chinese food.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Francis. Let's go over to Linda in Vermont. Where are you calling from in Vermont, Linda?
I'm a courier. And right now I live in Half Moon. I'm on my way to Essex Junction.
Oh, well, that's a long drive. Well, listen, hope you're driving safely and you're hands-free.
Yeah, I'm hands-free.
Okay, you're on with Willa.
You cannot forget Saratoga chips. That's what we're famous for in this area.
Oh, the potato chips. Right.
Potato chip was invented in Saratoga.
That's true. Thanks for the reminder. Yes, and that great story of it was sliced too thin by accident and thrown in oil, and it actually ended up being a happy accident. Yeah, thanks for that reminder of that story.
That's right.
The guy said he always likes his home fries crisp, so they turned out to be potato chips, and he thought they were great.
Interesting. Now, how much of that story is actually true? Have you ever looked into the history of this, Willa?
Well, you know, for most dishes on the planet, we don't really have a good record of when it was invented or how it was invented. So this is a good, it's been a story that's been told many times. It's probably true, but we don't really have, you know, there's always somebody who claims that they did it first. So we don't really know, but this one, it's a likelihood that this guy did actually invent the potato chip by shaving his potatoes a little too thin and throwing them in oil and saying, that's how I like them. And they became really tasty and a popular treat.
Linda, thank you very much for calling. We appreciate it. Drive safely. You know, just thought of this now. There's only 2 minutes left. This whole business in Europe back in the day of putting live critters in pies. Have you ever looked into that?
Oh, that's definitely something people
Frightening.
Did.
Frightening.
It was actually not meant to be frightening. It was meant to be fun.
Entertainment.
Well, this is when we're talking about, you know, the Renaissance and the medieval period. People would put live birds and things in pies. And
small people.
Not small people, toads and birds. You know, critters that fly out, and you'd have this magnificent show of birds flying out at you or little toads hopping out. And it was considered amusement and fun rather than nowadays. If you did that for your kid for a birthday party, you'd probably get called by Child Protective Services.
Oh, I think you're right. But, I mean, there were recipes about how to do it. And what does it tell you about society?
Our sense of humor's evolved.
This is a very strange bit of entertainment. No, you've heard the story, right, about one of the kings of England who went, and he just gotten married, and they went around on a tour, and one of the towns baked a very small person into a pie who jumped out, and he became the royal midget.
Are you thinking about your bachelor party?
No, this is true. Look it up. No, I swear, I saw it on the internet. All right, Willa Zen, this was a lot of fun today. Any words of wisdom in the final 40 seconds here that you can make us all smarter with?
Eat, drink, and be merry, and I will give you the phrase I learned in Basque country.
What's
to
that?
Say, choch. It says, bring it on, enjoy the good times.
All right, and the website at the CIA. Jeff, let's turn Jeff's mic back on for a second, Zach, if we can get you there. Website.
It's ciachef.edu, and there's tabs for the restaurants on campus and for food enthusiast programs and cookbooks and everything else.
So your job is basically to make sure they don't go over the line, because you're here every time we have a guest from CIA.
It's actually to drive them because they don't know the way to Central Avenue in Albany.
You're not like a handler, like in a communist country, they have a handler.
Willa will never be heard from again if she says something wrong. No, that's
I'm
not
just
the
smiling.
Case at all.
I'm not going to defect.
I mean, the science guy. We're not going to see him again, right? All right. Well, listen, thinking about Ted Russin there. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Support comes from Spirit House, Amherst, Massachusetts, a family-owned wine, beer, and spirits retailer offering organically farmed wines from around the world. Wine tasting Saturday afternoons, spirithaus.com. O'Reilly, Talbot, and Oaken Associates, providing environmental engineering services for Springfield and Western New England, oto-env.com. And Charles Padula, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady, cosmetic dentistry, utilizing Invisalign. That's right, Invisalign, where teeth can be orthodontically moved without braces. PadulaDDS.com. Don't forget now, we have the lockbox at WAMC.org. Our fun drive begins on June 1st, and that's an on-air affair. Alan Shartok will be down at the microphone at 6 a.m. on that Monday morning. But what we're doing now, between now and then, we have the WAMC lockbox. And if you go to WAMC.org and make your pledge now, every dollar we raise will count on the first minute of the fund drive. Last year, we had a 3.5-day $1 million fund drive because everybody chipped in the lockbox. So I encourage you to do that, wamc.org. Thanks again for listening today and for this week on Vox Pop. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Zach, you did an admirable job of staying awake today. Wonderful. Your phones were answered by Barb King, our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. Thanks again for being here. Alan will be in the host chair on Monday at 2 for a Medical Monday. Have a great weekend.